planned. We wheeled it together, week after week, session after session. I don't know any other way for a person like Mary to reach a place of freedom and positive self-regard than through a loving relationship. It does not have to be with a therapist, but that is one controlled way to do it. Most people who tend to take care of others first do not have the major childhood antecedents Mary had, and so do not need to go into the depth she needed to. For those, I will offer some tips. But first, as with Les, Jean, Ashley, and Jack, I note the dangers Mary created for herself using the basic plan as an outline. 1. Energy. Taking care of others is mentally exhausting. 2. Emotion. A strange mental exchange occurs when you take on other people's stuff, their negative emotions. It's called projective identification, which is a fancy term that means you, the handler, get filled with the toxic stuff that fills the person you're helping. You then launder the dirty clothes, so to speak, by holding them for a while, then returning the cleaned up material to the person you're helping. All this puts you in a precarious state emotionally yourself. 3. Engagement. Engaging with other people's problems curtails your ability to engage with your own work. 4. Structure. You tend to ignore the structures that would guide you to take care of yourself if you are taking care of others too much. 5. Control. Your reflex to help others start to control you if you don't understand what's happening and take steps to prevent it. What to do about it? 10 tips for helping you take care of yourself, not just everyone else. 1. Recognize that your gut reaction, your reflexive, subconscious, emotional initial response, is to take care of others first. Realize that your set point is to make sure everyone else in the organization is happy before you tend to your own situation. 2. Recognize that this tendency is admirable in many ways and extremely valuable to the organization, as long as you couple it with an ability to take care of yourself. 3. Understand that taking care of yourself is not the same as being selfish. That's why the airlines tell you to put the oxygen mask on yourself first. The reason they give you this perfectly obvious bit of advice is that so many of us are like Mary, inclined to take care of others first. 4. Think this through. You've got to get your head around the fact that taking care of yourself is good for the entire organization. Doing the opposite runs deep in many people, particularly women. Talk it through with others until you understand that it is good, right, and necessary to take care of yourself if you are going to be of any use to anyone else. 5. Schedule time for yourself into your day. For example, set aside uninterrupted time to work on difficult problems, time to exercise or do yoga, time to get enough sleep, time for meditation, prayer, or some other reflective practice, and time for lovemaking. Yes, this is good for you. 6. Learn to say, "Let me think about that," rather than automatically saying yes. If you reset your automatic response to, "Let me think about that," you will give yourself enough time to decide if it makes sense for you to take something on or if you can politely decline. 7. When someone you work with is in distress, consider if you are the best person to jump in and help. Once you've jumped in, it's hard to jump out. So jump in only if A. you have time to take on what could be a prolonged project, B. if you are the person best qualified to provide the help needed, and C. you have the energy and emotional reserves to offer the help needed. 8. Learn to ask for help. Most caretakers are what's called counterdependent, which means they are far more comfortable providing help than receiving it. Go outside your comfort zone and learn to ask for help. People will feel pleased that you asked. As you know only too well, it feels good to be needed. 9. Remember, if you don't have the time or energy to provide help, someone else in the organization can help. And the less you help, the more others will fill the void you create. 10. Finally, for all your efforts, be glad of who you are. As problems go, being a caretaker is a good one to have. The world benefits from you a lot. You've just got to learn to pull back a bit so you can survive and thrive. Chapter 6. Dropping the Ball. How to Stop Underachieving at Work. People who have ADHD tend to agree with the following statements. Planning is very difficult for me. Procrastination is my middle name. I love crises. That's when I focus best. I am long on imagination, but short on follow-through. I'd rather have a root canal than attend a meeting. I am frustrated because I am not making the best use of my talents. I'm impulsive. Punctuality is a problem for me. I get irritated with people who are not as mentally quick as I am. I do things whole hog, even to excess. I hate myself, Sharon said to the wall. Sitting at her desk, she had just realized that she'd spaced out on a conference call she was supposed to have been on for the past hour. She thought the call was to take place tomorrow, until she'd looked down at her planner and saw that it was scheduled for today. Her mind raced. Why didn't I check my planner when I got to the office? Why do I resolve to do it every day, then not do it? Why do I know what I'm supposed to do, but then not do what I'm supposed to do? Do I have some kind of a fear of failure? Do I secretly want to ruin my life? Am I trying to fail in order to please my mother, or am I afraid of surpassing her? Why hasn't all the effing therapy I've had not done a damn thing to help me? Is there any hope? Am I doomed to live this pattern out over and over and over again? Why doesn't someone just shoot me? Avery, one of her colleagues at the magazine, who was also a friend, walked by her office and could see Sharon was in distress. What's wrong, hon? Avery asked. Sharon sighed. You don't want to hear. I'm a loser. That's the long and short of it. I just missed the conference call with Tony's group, and I'm sure that it would be the last straw for them. What could have been a golden opportunity turns into another swing and miss by good old Sharon. I'm so over being me. Sharon, hon, you're the most talented person at this magazine. I wish I had half your ability. I love you, Avery, but do you know how tired I am of hearing how much potential I have? What's the good of having potential if you can never live up to it? I wish I'd been born dumb as a post. Then I wouldn't have to live up to anything, which I can't do anyway. You know what? Avery replied. I've got to go take care of a couple of things right now, but I'm coming back here at 5 sharp, and I am taking you across the street to the Algonquin for a couple of the best mojitos you've ever had, and you are not allowed to say no. Thanks, Avery. Gives me something to look forward to. Unlike the previous 5 examples, Sharon's story is not about ADT, but rather true attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. I include it because ADHD is far more common in adults than most people realize, affecting at least 5 million adults in the United States, 80% of whom are not diagnosed. Treating ADHD in an adult can change that person's life dramatically for the better. 39-year-old Sharon has worked as a senior editor at a major women's magazine for years. She'd risen through the ranks, but she had been unable to reach the top tier due to a chronic problem with planning, prioritizing, and following through. In fact, had it not been for her considerable talent and brilliance, she would have been let go long ago. Sharon made sense, albeit an intensely painful sense, of her underachieving ways by chastising herself in an unremittingly harsh inner voice. She reserved her sharpest condemnations in life not for anyone or anything else, but for herself, routinely invoking coarse terms like loser, slacker, airhead, ditz, fraud, cheat, charlatan, idiot, pathetic, or weak. As inaccurate as all those terms were, and the sane part of her knew they were wildly inaccurate, she felt better for some weird reason, lacerating her mind and soul, than living without knowing why she'd never been able to make the most of her immense talents. Author Byron Katie, in her musings on how we hold ourselves back in life, suggests asking yourself the liberating question, who would you be without that thought? But Sharon couldn't imagine herself being without that thought. In her case, her many thoughts of how inept and inadequate she was. She made a moral diagnosis of herself and clung to it. She felt she'd be crippled without self-condemnation. She was unable to let go of the thoughts that did her in her own mind, because without them, she would be left with no explanation at all. It was as if her self-condemnation provided a skeleton upon which the rest of her could hang. Right now, as Avery had discovered, she was in a deep funk. Every once in a while, it hit her hard. How much she'd underachieved in her life, how everyone in high school and college had thought she'd become an important novelist, only to see that dream yield to her need to make a living. Hence the compromise of editorial work. In this funk, she found it impossible to focus on the work she had to do. Her feelings of shame and dismay shot through her like a singeing current, carrying pain throughout her body and soul. But she was also tough as sinew. Like a kicked mutt who knows how to survive, she knew how to fight through anything. Fight. That had been her chief coping style her whole life. She spoke no words to herself when she had to act. She just took action. Deeper than words, a titanic storm of determination roiled within her that would never allow her to give up. So, through the funk, she fought. Sharon's backstory. 12 weeks premature at birth, Sharon had had to fight from the moment she entered the world. Her dad, Douglas, doted on her, but her mom competed with her. She learned from her mother and her three older brothers that she had to fight to survive. "It's your red hair," her dad would say. "It's why you're such a pistol." Sharon was both the daughter her dad had always wanted and the daughter her mother had never wanted. Elaine, Sharon's mom, herself had grown up under the critical eye of an exacting, cold mother. Elaine had been able to develop affection for her boys, but she'd always sensed that a daughter would only bring out the worst in her, just as she'd brought out the worst in her own mother. And how right she turned out to be. Elaine competed with baby Sharon for Douglas's attention. When Douglas doted on Sharon, Elaine would either fly into a rage or sulk or both. Fortunately, Douglas wouldn't let his wife separate him from his daughter, so their relationship flourished. But Elaine tried to undermine Sharon every step of the way. It was as if her worst nightmare was that her daughter would succeed and find the joy in childhood she herself had never found. Whether it was her red hair, as her dad said, or a fighter's genes, Sharon needed every bit of extra energy she could summon, not only to fend off her mother, but to get an education and do it right. Her parents had high expectations for the four kids, but their expectations were nothing compared to Sharon's expectations for herself. She wanted to win at everything, excel at everything, and be number one, no matter what the activity or task. Schoolwork did not come easily. Not only did Sharon have her mother's constant undermining criticisms to deal with, but her mind also wandered all the time. She would be looking out the window when the teacher called on her, and she'd be publicly embarrassed by her inability to respond. Rather than give up, though, she bore down. She borrowed notes, she went for extra help, she stayed in and studied while others played, and she saw to it that she did excel. She got A's. If she ever got a B, God help that teacher, because Sharon would be back in, not to argue for a higher grade, but to get extra help every day. She also took to sports with abandon. She ran track and found exhilaration in running. In winter, she found the same high in swimming. She wanted to dive, too, but since she could not do both for the team, she chose to swim, just to prove that she could endure the physical punishment that long-distance swimming demanded. Pain turned into pleasure when she reached a certain point in her workouts. She thanked her mother for this. She courted extreme sports and high achievement to win the battle her mother had drawn her into. Then, in 10th grade, an English teacher, Mr. Elliot, changed her life. He turned Sharon on to literature, starting with the poetry of Emily Dickinson. Sharon loved the brief lines, the short takes. "I heard a fly buzz when I died." Lines like that amazed and delighted Sharon in a way nothing in school had before. Lines from Dickinson's poem about a snake embedded in Sharon's mind. "But never met this fellow, attended or alone, without a tighter breathing, and zero at the bone." Zero at the bone. How perfect, she thought. How exactly perfect. But how did she think of that phrase, zero at the bone? Where did it come from? She wanted desperately to know, so she could make such lines come to her as well. With Mr. Elliot's encouragement, Sharon set to find out where such surprises actually do come from. "They come from your unconscious, your imagination," Mr. Elliot had said. "You have a great imagination. Try trusting it." "What do you mean?" Sharon had asked. "You are so tenacious. That's great, but sometimes you just need to let go of control and let your mind surprise you. I can guarantee you, Emily Dickinson was as surprised as anyone when she wrote the words, zero at the bone." From then on, Sharon had found a new playground, her favorite playground, the world of imagination, images, and words. She wrote poetry in the manner of Dickinson, but gradually it grew into the manner of Sharon. She also wrote prose and was a natural storyteller. Over time, from 10th grade on, she found her own voice so that she could write without faking it or imitating someone else. She looked forward to college and the delights she knew she'd take in literature. But due to her problems with sustaining focus on tests, she scored poorly on the SATs and did not get into the Ivy League colleges she'd hoped to attend. Due to her excellent grades and recommendations, however, she did get into a number of good colleges. She ended up choosing Hobart and William Smith Colleges in upstate New York. She embraced literature and writing there. However, she found that she could not sustain a story long enough to turn it into something substantial. She became editor of the college literary magazine, but she did not publish much of her own writing. Her mother carped, "Be more practical. We won't support you, and there's no money in being a failed writer." Sharon knew that her mother would cringe in envy if she succeeded as a writer, but she did see that her mother had a point. The last thing she wanted to do was give her mother the satisfaction of seeing Sharon beg for financial help. She did have to make a living. So after school, she entered a world she knew she could excel in, the world of editing. Her dreams fading, she nonetheless did well in her career. All her supervisors recognized what Mr. Elliot had seen: great talent, drive, and imagination. She knew she was different from other people, though, in a way she could not explain, nor could others understand. When a friend or colleague would say, "Sharon, you're so talented. Why don't you get an organizer or a coach or something so you can make the most of what you've got?" she didn't know how to explain that she just couldn't. Out of sheer frustration, out of the need for an answer, any answer, she began to invoke the black list of hateful terms she applied to herself, like daily punishments. When one of her brothers would ask, "Why can't you last in a relationship with a guy? Aren't any of them good enough for you?" she didn't know how to explain that it was she who felt inadequate and not up to the task of connecting in a normal way. So she'd say, "I'm just a selfish person." As wrong as that was, it was an answer. She also detected many correct answers, not about herself, but about others and the world. She had a knack, both a gift and a curse, for seeing what other people did not see. She could see into a person in a second, telephony in a heartbeat, and know what someone else was thinking simply by looking at them or diagnosing what was really going on in a meeting in seconds. The word diagnosis literally means knowing through. Sharon could know through anyone and anything. It was as if she had X-ray vision. This perceptiveness could help her, but, often as not, it could also isolate her, because she could not easily share what she knew. She carried with her so much emotion, so much insight, that it could wear her out. She tried to use her editing as a way of getting down to the concrete and practical, so as to avoid the thoughts and feelings that always pulsed through her. But even in editing, she could tell a false voice on the page. She could see a manipulative writer work his way from sentence to sentence, and, at times, it was all she could do not to scream in frustration at reading the stuff. She'd grip her desk in an effort to control her mind. But try as she might, her mental focus resembled a toddler on a picnic. It went wherever it wanted to go, with no regard for danger or authority. Controlling it was beyond difficult. It felt impossible. She knew deep inside that if she could only find the key to sustaining her focus, she could write the novels and the stories she had in her, and she could sustain a relationship with a man. She could fulfill another dream, become a mother, and be the kind of mother she wished she'd had herself. But for now, all of that eluded her, and she felt ashamed. She'd never give in. She knew this as she sat at her desk. But she wondered what would become of her. Life with ADHD. One of the millions of adults in the United States who have undiagnosed attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, Sharon had a chance to change her life for the better in a big way. There is no diagnosis relating to the mind that carries with it a more dramatic opportunity for changing a life for the better. And yet, as I've stated, at least 80% of adults who have ADHD don't know it. So they languish, and they underachieve, like Sharon. Some get into severe trouble. The prisons are full of adults with undiagnosed ADHD, as are the lines of the unemployed, the drug and alcohol addicted, the accident-prone, the depressed and anxious, and the marginalized. Fortunately, due to her tenacity and native talent, Sharon had done well, compared to the millions whom ADHD severely impairs. But she still was underachieving in a major way, and she knew it. It was a matter of time before depression and even despair took her down further, to a point where she would be unable to do what she was doing. For various reasons, most people, including most doctors, do not know much, if anything, about ADHD in adults. They believe it is a childhood condition of overactive boys. As a result, the millions of adults who could become hugely successful once their ADHD is treated never get the help they so desperately need. With proper help, adults who have this trait can excel at the highest level. Nobel Prize winners, Pulitzer Prize winners, self-made billionaires, Academy Award winners, entrepreneurs of all kinds, and various others at the top of their fields all share this fascinating, widely misunderstood trait. What makes ADHD so interesting is that it is composed of such beneficial and problematic elements. Treatment aims to take advantage of the positives while limiting the damage done by the negatives. I've been working with adults who have ADHD since I first learned about it in 1981. I have the condition myself, as well as dyslexia. I've learned that with proper management, these conditions can actually be turned into prime assets in one's life. That's why I see myself not as a specialist in treating disabilities, but as a specialist in helping people unwrap their gifts. With the proper diagnosis, Sharon could begin to unwrap her own gifts and undo the decades of disappointment and self-attack she's endured. Sharon, and the millions of adults like her, lives one insight away from embarking on new and improved life. People who have ADHD sabotage themselves, not due to some unconscious conflict, but because of the way that their brains are wired. They become victims of their brain's shortcomings and cannot gain access to the brilliance their brain usually does possess. Beyond just those who have ADHD, millions more underachieve because they don't know how to manage the brain they have. Some years ago, I wrote a children's story called A Walk in the Rain with a Brain, which contains the refrain, "No brain is the same, no brain is the best. Each brain finds its own special way." Due to the widespread failure of the educational system, as well as a paucity of experts on the subject of practical brain management, most people never come to understand and master their own brain's special way. They may not flounder, but neither do they excel as they otherwise could. My first step in helping Sharon was to reframe her condition. She was stuck in a thicket from which she needed to be freed. Possessing great talent, she underachieved not through lack of effort or discipline, but because she suffered from untreated ADHD. Telling her to try harder would be like telling a person who is nearsighted to squint harder. Our work together began with education. I recommended that she read my book, Delivered from Distraction, as it provides a quick way of learning a lot about ADHD. A fast reader, she was happy to do this. But were she not an avid reader, I would have asked her just to read the first chapter of the book, which is called The Skinny. Read this if you can't read the whole book. Once she understood ADHD and the positive qualities inherent in it, like creativity, spunk, originality, grit, and energy, then we started unwrapping. Stimulant medications like Ritalin or Adderall can be a godsend. They work about 80% of the time. Medication for ADHD can be like eyeglasses. It helps a person focus more effectively. Used properly, it has no side effects other than appetite suppression without unwanted weight loss. Any other side effects can be eliminated by changing the dose or discontinuing the medication. In addition to medication, the rest of the treatment includes exercise, nutrition, meditation, positive human contact, learning to get into the right place emotionally, and learning structure, which an ADHD coach can help with. Coaching is a relatively new field. Many people represent themselves as ADHD coaches, but since the field is not regulated, it can be difficult to find a qualified coach worth the time and money you invest. I recommend three groups whose personnel I can vouch for: ADD Coach Academy, addca.com, ADHD Coaches Organization, ADHDcoaches.org, and the Edge Foundation, edgefoundation.org. As with all adults who have undiagnosed ADHD, Sharon simply didn't know that a treatable condition was holding her back. It was as if she were driving on square wheels. The shipwreck of her life was that she had given up her dreams, dreams that she actually could achieve. Luckily, the stimulant Adderall helped Sharon immediately. With an 80% track record, lucky is perhaps the wrong word. In any case, as so often happens, Sharon got immediate benefit from medication. She then became able to rethink all that had happened to her until the time we met. A born fighter, she got angry that this diagnosis had been missed. But that anger only fueled her desire to reach for the dreams she'd never quite forgotten. The easy part of the treatment was taking the medication. It helped her focus quite dramatically. It turned her square wheels into round ones. But this was only the beginning. She had lived her entire life with a negative view of herself. As spunky, driven, and resilient as she was, she suffered inside. The damage done early in life to those who have learning differences can be traumatic. One of my friends, David Neilman, is the founder of JetBlue Airways. Neilman has ADHD in spades. The day JetBlue went public, Neilman made millions of dollars in a matter of hours. He told me, driving home that night, was I looking forward to celebrating? No. I felt like the same loser who couldn't hack it in high school. We don't have a medication to revamp a person's self-image. With Sharon, I did what I do with all the adults I diagnose and treat. I sat with her, listened, explored, bore the pain with her, and gradually detoxified many of the conflicted feelings that came up. She was excited to have a new life, to have round wheels. But she was also confused and angry. Why had it taken so long to find out? Why had no one picked up on it when she was in school? And why had her mother been so critical rather than helpful? Addressing all this takes time. Gradually, though, Sharon reawakened her dreams of writing and her faith in her own ability, and she started writing regularly. It's never too late. My oldest patient is 86. He came to see me because he'd been trying to write a book his entire life. Once we diagnosed and treated his ADHD, he was able to begin the book. Here's how the basic plan applied to Sharon's ADHD. 1. Energy. Sharon had a ton of energy, as most people with ADHD do, but she was not able to direct it or control it. 2. Emotion. Her emotions fluctuated so much that it was difficult for her to stay in a steady emotional state. 3. Engagement. Sharon's focus came and went. At times she could reach a state of acute focus and engage, at other times, not at all. 4. Structure. Sharon had great difficulty in creating the basic structures, lists, plans, schedules, that are essential for success. 5. Control. Sharon has great difficulty controlling the powers of her mind. It was like a Ferrari with no brakes. What to do about it? 10 tips for adults who have ADHD. 1. Learn as much as you can about the condition. Misconceptions and wrong information about ADHD are prevalent on the internet, so don't start there. Read my book, Delivered from Distraction, co-authored with John Rady, or Fast Minds, How to Thrive If You Have Adult ADHD by Craig Sermon, MD, Tim Bilkey, and Karen Weintraub. Taking Charge of Adult ADHD by Russell Barkley, PhD, or The Mindfulness Prescription for Adult ADHD by Lydia Zylowska, MD, and Daniel Siegel. 2. Embrace ADHD, even though the term is terrible. ADHD does not involve a deficit of attention, but rather wandering. Hyperactivity is usually absent in adults. And it is not a disorder, in my opinion, but rather a trait, which can serve a person wonderfully well as long as she manages it properly. The analogy I use with children applies to adults just as well. I tell them they have a Ferrari engine for a brain with bicycle brakes. A Ferrari with no brakes is dangerous, but once the brakes get strengthened, then they're champions in the making. And, as I tell the kids, I am a brake specialist. 3. Understand that it is ADHD and not some moral failing or deficiency in character that has held you back and caused chronic underachievement. With proper management, the sky is now the limit. 4. Work with a doctor who has experience in helping adults with ADHD and who endorses a strength-based approach. Finding such a person may take some legwork, but it is worth putting in the effort, you might start with the Department of Psychiatry at the medical school nearest you. 5. Be proud of what you've got, because the positives can't be bought and can't be taught, while the negatives can be dealt with once you find the right help. I've renamed this trait the American Edge, as our gene pool is full of it. Just think of who came to this country in the waves of immigration and colonized it. Dreamers, explorers, pioneers, risk-takers, innovators, and entrepreneurs. Indeed, most entrepreneurs have ADHD. 6. Work with a coach to help develop skills of organization and time management. You might also download an app I created called Crazy Busy. It helps you prioritize tasks, assess the value of a given task, and organize tasks. It gives various tips, has a timer and stopwatch, offers guided meditation, and contains various tips on dealing with fast-paced life. 7. Meditation, physical exercise, proper nutrition, and sufficient sleep all make ADHD, and life in general, better. 8. Don't fear medication. Used properly, it can be as helpful as eyeglasses. Just make sure you work with a qualified doctor. 9. Do what you're good at as much as possible. Many adults with ADHD feel compelled to try to get good at what they're bad at and waste a lot of time in the process. 10. Share what you've learned with others. ADHD in adults remains vastly unrecognized. Once you reap the benefits of diagnosis and treatment, share that with others to whom it might apply. Part 2. Training Your Attention. How to Manage and Maintain Your Ability to Focus. Chapter 7. Flexible Focus. Creating the Optimal State for Excellence. In March 2012, Bubba Watson, a professional golfer, held a 3-shot lead over the competition heading into Sunday's final round in the Doral Open at the Blue Monster Course in Doral, Florida. For a pro golfer, a 3-shot lead in the final round is by no means safe, but it is solid. Bubba was an odds-on favorite to win the tournament when he teed off Sunday. One of the longest hitters in the game and, by most accounts, its most creative inventor of shots on the spot, Watson had all the talent in the world. What he lacked was focus. At Doral, he faltered on the front 9 holes and lost his 3-stroke lead. The tournament suddenly became a tense race to the finish. On television, commentator Johnny Miller criticized Watson for his inability to stay focused, lamenting that if he could ever learn how to focus consistently, he'd win many championships. Experts all agreed that Watson's lack of sustained focus held him back from achieving greatness. However, something changed in Watson when he played later that year at the Masters Golf Tournament at Augusta National in Georgia. On one of the greatest stages in all of golf, at the tournament and course created by golf's greatest folk hero, Bobby Jones, Watson discovered his elusive focus. Going into Sunday's final round of the Masters, he trailed the leader of the tournament by 2 shots. He was within striking distance for sure. But on the 4th hole, something happened that would normally have knocked Watson off his game and into a tailspin. His competitor, Louis Oosthuizen, made one of the most spectacular shots in golf history. He made what's called a double eagle. If you're not familiar with the game, an eagle is a score 2 below par on a given hole, par being the score a player would get if he played each shot properly on a given hole. 1 under par on a hole is excellent. It is called a birdie. 2 under par is extraordinary. It is called an eagle. 3 under par on one hole is almost unheard of. It is called a double eagle. Oosthuizen scored an otherworldly 2 on the par 5 fourth hole, one of the most amazing scores ever put up in golf history during one of its most storied tournaments. If there were ever a time for Watson to lose his focus, playing along with Oosthuizen, when he made the double eagle, would have been it. But after seeing his competitor make golf history, Watson didn't blow up or choke. Instead, he bore down. He gained focus rather than losing it, and avoided the disasters that had plagued him in the past. By the 18th hole, both Watson and Oosthuizen were in position to win the tournament, provided either of them could sink just one putt on the 18th green. But both of them missed. The tournament headed into a sudden-death playoff. In golf, nothing is tenser than sudden death. It means that the first player to win a hole wins the tournament. The other player goes home. On the first hole of the sudden-death playoff, both players once again had a chance to win, but failed to make their putts. The tournament headed into a second hole of sudden death. This time around, Watson made an errant swing, driving his ball far to the right and into the tall pine trees that border the fairway, the landing area a player aims for when he hits his drive. It looked like a disaster, a sure defeat. It seemed that his old demon, lack of focus, had finally bitten him and taken him down. He had hit a really bad shot, and at the worst possible time. Bubba blows it. That would be the headline Monday morning and on tweets in the minutes to come. But it didn't work out that way. Watson found his ball some 30 yards deep into the woods, sitting embarrassedly on a bed of pine straw. The logical play, the play every sensible golfer would make, would be to hit a safe shot from the trees out onto the fairway, try to make par, and hope Oosthuizen didn't make birdie. There was no other realistic shot besides the safe shot out onto the fairway. Or, so it seemed to everyone in the world who was watching. Except to Watson. He'd say later that he'd been at the same place in the woods before, so the choice of shot was a no-brainer. Wasting little time, he took his stance and, using a special grip and swing of his own invention, hit his ball out from under the overhanging trees. He had to make his ball do the seemingly impossible. The ball had to go straight and up to escape the overhanging trees, and then it had to make a right turn. Expert players can make a ball go straight, or they can make it turn right. But to do both on the same shot requires extraordinary skill, or, some would say, magical powers. Watson made his ball perform that magic. It flew up and away, obediently taking a sharp right at just the right juncture, curving some 40 yards, and then it floated down onto the green where it rolled to within 15 feet of the cup. Now, Oosthuizen didn't stand a chance. Watson won the tournament, to everyone's total amazement. What happened to Watson at the Masters? No one knows just how he did it. Most people agreed that he looked different than he usually did. His jaw was set, his eyes looked straight ahead, and he didn't goof around with the gallery, and he displayed none of his usual outward signs of distraction. Some thought it had something to do with the fact that he and his wife had adopted their first child just days before the tournament. When Watson went off to Augusta, his wife and baby had to stay home because the infant was too young to travel. But in his mind, they were right there with him. As both a parent and a child psychiatrist, I believe that nothing changes a person more dramatically and permanently than the experience of becoming a parent. At that moment, a person enters into a permanent state of psychosis. You fall insanely in love with the squirming, squalling, peeing and pooping machine you've just brought into the world. Where Watson found his focus is anybody's guess. But that he found it is beyond question. My guess is that he took advantage of three factors that, in combination, create mental focus. They are structure, novelty, and motivation. Every golf shot combines all three. The game is highly structured. Each shot is unique in its own way, hence novel. And the player wants to do well, hence the motivation. I believe Oosthuizen's double eagle on the fourth hole served to get Watson's attention and motivate him. For a moment, on the second hole of sudden death, Watson relapsed, lost focus, and hit a ball into the trees. But then, faced with an impossible shot, he drew on his creativity and hit the shot of his life. What is flexible focus? Focus varies in its intensity and duration. At one extreme is the absence of focus, without being asleep, drunk, in a coma, or deprived of focus by some other physical cause. I call this aimless, meandering state, drift. It can be a sweet state indeed, or a time waster. Your mind simply drifts along like a fisherman trawling. Sometimes, in drift, you catch a big fish. You don't know it, but your brain uses these seemingly empty moments to do a lot of work. It goes into what's called default mode, activating the default network, or DN. Particularly active in these moments of daydreaming or drift are the lateral prefrontal cortex and the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex, both of which are crucial in so-called executive function, which includes planning and focusing attention. This explains, in part, why you need to look away from what you're doing from time to time. To drift. To take a break mentally. Your brain does not take a break during these periods. Quite the opposite. It stokes up on energy, element number one in the basic plan, equipping you for the next period of paying close attention. You might think the brain would consume more energy when working on a problem or concentrating on a task, but it doesn't. When in drift, the DM consumes just as much, if not more, energy than when deeply in focus mode. Interestingly, in drift or in DN, what you think about, since your brain never goes empty, is usually other people, yourself, and the relationships among those. You engage in social cognition. Nature wired us to think socially during its downtimes. As psychologist Matthew Lieberman, a pioneer in social neuroscience, put it, there are so many other things our brain could have been wired to spend its spare time on. Learning calculus, improving our logical reasoning ability, cataloging variations in the classes of objects we have seen. Any of these could have adaptive value. But nature placed its bet on our thinking socially. At the other extreme of drift is flow. The psychologist who researched this heightened state of awareness, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, named this most focused state of mind in 1975. In flow, a person becomes so immersed in what he is doing that he loses self-consciousness altogether. He gets so into what he is doing that he merges with the action he is involved in, becoming one with it. He loses his sense of time, even his awareness of his biological needs and drives, a state reminiscent of William Butler Yeats's lines, "O body swayed to music, O brightening glance, how can we know the dancer from the dance?" Like all moments of peak intensity, flow fades. Almost all of us have entered into flow at one time or another, so we know firsthand that it doesn't last. Some people find flow while running or doing yoga. Others while playing music, meditating, knitting, doing crossword puzzles. Others while risking their lives skiing downhill or sweating over a piece of sculpture. According to Csikszentmihalyi's research, corroborated by many people I've interviewed as well as my own experience, in flow, a person experiences life at its peak, its most joyful, it's most intensely fulfilling. It is also the state in which people exceed their personal best, often achieving much better work than they've ever done before. So absorbing, however, is the flow state that you only recollect the high of it, the pure joy of it. Since you lose self-consciousness when you're in flow, you're not aware of how great it is until it's over. But you can't spend your whole day in flow. You need to eat and sleep. Furthermore, the brain in that state is limited by its supply of neurotransmitters. With practice, however, you can learn to enter flow regularly. The key is to engage in some activity that both matters to you deeply and is challenging, so that you have to stretch. Csikszentmihalyi's work has been extended in practical directions by Stephen Kotler, Director of Research for the Flow Genome Project, an international transdisciplinary organization dedicated to decoding what happens during flow. Kotler and his group are developing methods for hacking flow, as he puts it, as it occurs in everyday life. Most of his research has been with athletes who do extreme sports that often put their lives in danger. He's found that these athletes access flow regularly, and that when they do, they routinely exceed their personal best. In these cases, great gain comes with great risk. But it is a safe assumption that most people do not want to put their lives in danger in order to access flow. For us, and I certainly include myself in this group, the doorway to flow still remains open. We need to select those activities that both challenge us and matter deeply to us. For example, in my case, this challenge comes with writing. I have a love-hate relationship with writing. Most writers do. That's because writing is beyond challenging. At times, it seems impossible. The writing is almost never as good as it could be, or as the writer hopes it will be, so the task promises disappointment at every turn. That's why we writers often avoid writing. When Ernest Hemingway was asked how to write a novel, he replied, "The first thing you do is clean out the refrigerator." He meant that writers will do just about anything to avoid putting words onto a page. Yet we love what we do, too. Few things please me more than creating a well-turned sentence or describing an image that does its job succinctly. I hope you find a few in this audiobook. They are my reasons for coming back to the blank page, just as the great shot is the golfer's reason for coming back to the tee, in spite of all his bad shots. When I finally do sit down at the keyboard, I typically enter flow, usually for minutes, but sometimes for an hour. The difference between my experience with writing and that of, say, the extreme skier is that I do not have the element of danger to keep me riveted in flow for extended periods. As a result, flow comes and goes as I write. I suppose if I were writing with my life on the line, I might remain in flow for a longer time. Short of flow, there is focus. We all know what focus is. It is the standard term for a concentrated, clear state of mind focused on one target. Between focus and flow lies what I call flexible focus. It differs from flow in that it's not the high that flow is. It's a way of tapping into some of the qualities of flow without being so absorbed that you can't attend to anything else. In a state of flexible focus, you retain the ability to concentrate on a task, while, at the same time, remaining open to new input. Flexible focus is a hybrid of flow that's accessible in everyday life. When in a state of flexible focus, you have a semi-permeable boundary around your mind that allows for some distraction and sometimes the arrival of a new and important idea. For example, consider the case of David Neeleman, the founder of JetBlue. Neeleman invented the electronic ticket, one of the most important innovations in the business of aviation in the past 20 years. "I didn't plan to do it," he told me. "I just saw the idea one day. It seemed so obvious. I didn't understand why someone else hadn't already thought of it. But in fact, everyone else in the business laughed at me, saying, 'No one will go to the airport without a paper ticket.' Of course, now we all do. And it saved the industry many millions and saved customers all kinds of anxiety and missed flights. What led to the idea? I asked. Nothing, Neelman said. Other than that, I'm always thinking of ways to improve the business. That's really all I do. Come up with ideas and develop them. The electronic ticket was just one of my better ones. But the process is the same with all of them. I get into a certain mode and ideas come. Neelman is not an artist. He's a businessman. But in thinking up the electronic ticket, his mind was in a state of open-minded readiness. He was pondering ways to improve efficiency, as most executives do. But instead of forcing an idea up from a rigid, established, well-trodden place, say, overvaluing or being invested in his own past experience or reading everything he could about improving efficiency, he put himself into a state of flexible focus and the idea appeared. Flexible focus embodies a paradox. In flexible focus, you hold onto and balance both the logical and creative parts of your brain at the same time. You combine both your creative powers with your powers to organize and analyze. You're able to take in new input without becoming sidetracked by it. You're able to stay on task, but not rigidly so. To achieve flexible focus, you instinctively balance right brain with left brain, creativity with discipline, randomness with organization. You can be searching while sticking with what you're doing, combining flexibility with rigor, spontaneity with structure, rule-breaking with rule adherence. You can mix a new way with a proven way, and a journey with a goal. This is the great cerebral balancing act, the major skill that allows you to master the challenges of your work and to take advantage of the opportunities with which modern life abounds. In achieving such a balance, you gain access to unbidden, unexpected thoughts, images, impulses, and emotions that can deepen any mental activity while you retain the ability to organize and develop the ideas you already have. In their book, The Innovator's DNA, Jeff Dyer, Hal Gregersen, and Clayton Christensen describe several of the characteristics common to innovative executives like Amazon's Jeff Bezos, Intuit's Scott Cook, and Salesforce.com's Mark Benioff. Innovators like these tend to push boundaries and take the opposite position of established processes or ways of thinking. They free associate. They connect wildly different ideas, inputs, and disciplines. They observe things closely and gather ideas from everyday phenomena. They like to experiment, and they enjoy stretching their minds and experience through travel and meeting people from other walks of life. In short, they are open-minded, curious, and more likely to find their own way rather than follow a preset path. In a Robert Frost poem quoted so often it has become cliché, the entire final stanza, with its memorable metric at the end, is worth reading. I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Novelty, the less traveled road, increases the chance for flexible focus, while repetition, conformity, and routine reduce that chance. However, too much novelty leads to chaos and confusion, which is why we need structure to bring novelty and its generator, imagination, under control. Let me illustrate flexible focus with another story of a recent breakthrough. Not only does the story illustrate flexible focus, but the discovery itself can guide your own ability to achieve this ideal state of mind. Design, not chance, underlies both flow and focus. As I pointed out, chance and the unconscious play prodigious roles in productive mental activity. but they make their best contributions when flowing freely with the least obstruction possible. It turns out, and this was the great discovery, that there actually is an overarching design in nature that